Obviously, in the measure that a person divests himself from willful attachments to the apprehensions of those stain-like figures, forms, and images, the wrappings of spiritual communications, he will prepare himself for the goods and communications they cause. Having left aside all those apprehensions, which are like curtains and veils covering the spiritual goods contained in them, he will receive these goods in greater abundance, clarity, freedom of spirit, and simplicity. If the soul desires to feed upon them, the spirit and senses will be so occupied that a free and simple communication of spirituality will be impossible. For obviously, if occupied with the mind, the intellect will have no freedom for the reception of those spiritual communications. Should a person desire to admit and pay attention to them, he would be setting up an encumbrance and remaining content with the least important, the form, images, and particular knowledge, which is the only kind of knowledge that he can get from these visions. For he is unable to apprehend or understand the more important factor, the spirituality infused in his soul. Neither does he know the way he receives it, nor how he may speak about it, since it is purely spiritual. According to his own way of knowing, the only knowledge that he can have about these visions concerns the less important element, the forms apprehended through the senses. I affirm consequently that the unintelligible or unimaginable element in these visions is communicated to it passively, exclusive of any effort of the soul to understand. The soul would not even know how to go about making this effort. The eyes of the soul, then, should be ever withdrawn from distinct, visible, and intelligible apprehensions. Such elements are pertinent to sense and provide no security or foundation for faith. Its eyes should be freed on the invisible, on what belongs not to sense but to spirit, and on what, as it is not contained in a sensible figure, brings the soul to union with God in faith, the proper means, as was said. These visions will be substantially advantageous to the soul insofar as faith is concerned, if it knows clearly how to reject their sensible and intelligible aspect and make good use of the purpose for which God gives them. As we pointed out, God's purpose in bestowing corporeal visions is not that a person desire and become attached to them. A question, though, may arise concerning the subject. If it is true that God is giving supernatural visions, does not want one thereby to desire, lean upon, or pay attention to them, why does he give them at all? Through them, an individual can fall into numerous dangers and errors, or at least encounter the many impediments to further progress described here. Furthermore, why would God do this if he can communicate to the soul, substantially and spiritually, what he bestows upon it through the sensible communication of these visions and forms? We shall explain our answer to this question in the following chapter. There we shall present for spiritual persons and their teachers that, in my opinion, is both important and necessary, we shall expound God's method and purpose, of which many are ignorant, in bestowing these visions. As a result of their ignorance about visions, many are unenlightened on how to behave and how to guide themselves or others through them into union. They think that, because of their awareness of the genuineness and divine origin of these visions, it is advantageous to admit and trust them. They do not reflect that, as with worldly goods, failure to deny them can be a hindrance and cause attachment and possessiveness concerning them. They consider it beneficial to admit some visions as true and reject others as false. In this way, they subject themselves and other souls to the considerable labor and danger of discerning the truth or falsity of these visions. God does not impose this task upon them, nor does he desire to expose of simple and unlearned people to this dangerous endeavor. For these persons have faith, the sound and safe doctrine by which they can advance. There is no advancing in faith without the closing of one's eyes to everything pertaining to the senses and to clear particular knowledge. Though Saint Peter was truly certain of his vision of Christ's glory in the Transfiguration, yet, after relating the fact in his second canonical epistle, he did not want anyone to take this as the chief testimony for certitude. But leading them on to faith, he declared, "We have a more certain testimony than this vision of Tabor. The sayings and words of the prophets, bearing testimony to Christ, which you must make good use of, as of a candle shining in a dark place." Reflecting upon this comparison, we discover the doctrine taught here, telling us to behold the faith spoken of by the prophets as we would a candle shining in a dark place. He asserts that we should live in darkness with our eyes closed to all other lights, and that in this darkness faith alone, which is dark also, should be the light that we use. If we want to employ these other bright lights of distinct knowledge, we cease to make use of faith, the dark light, and we cease to be enlightened in the dark place mentioned by Saint Peter. This place, the intellect, the holder on which the candle of faith is placed, must remain in darkness until the day in the next life when the clear vision of God dawns upon the soul, and in this life until the daybreak of transformation in an union with God, the goal of a person's journey. Chapter 17 of Book 2. A great deal may be said about God's intention, the elevation of a soul from its low state to divine union, and method of procedure in bestowing these goods. All spiritual books deal with these points, and in our explanation we will also consider them. Accordingly, in this chapter, I shall do no more than offer a sufficient solution to our doubt. The question is, since there is so much danger and hindrance to progress, extent in these supernatural visions, as we said, why does God, who is all-wise and in favor of removing obstacles and snares, communicate them? An answer to this requires the establishment of three fundamental principles. The first is taken from St. Paul's Epistle to the Romans. The works that are done by God are well ordered. The second comes from the Holy Spirit in the Book of Wisdom. This is similar to stating, God's wisdom, though it touches from one end to the other, from one extreme to the other, disposes all things gently. The third originates with the theologians who say, God moves each thing according to its mode. In order that God lift the soul from the extreme of its low state to the other extreme of the high state of divine union, he must obviously, in view of these fundamental principles, do so with order, gently, and according to the mode of the soul. Since the order followed in the process of knowing involves the forms and images of created things, and since knowledge is acquired through the senses, God, to achieve his work gently and to lift the soul to supreme knowledge, must begin by touching the low state and extreme of the senses. And from there, he must gradually bring the soul after its own manner to the other end, spiritual wisdom, which is incomprehensible to the senses. Thus, naturally or supernaturally, he brings a person to the Supreme Spirit of God by first instructing him through discursive meditation and through forms, images, and sensible means, according to the individual's own manner of acquiring knowledge. This is the reason God gives a person visions, forms, images, and other sensitive and spiritual knowledge, not because he does not desire to give spiritual wisdom immediately in the first act. He would do this if two extremes, human and divine sense and spirit, could, through the ordinary process, be united by only one act, and if he could exclude the many preparatory acts, which are so connected in gentle and orderly fashion, and that, as is the case with natural agents, each in the foundation and preparation for the next. The first preparative acts serve the second, and the second the third, and so on. Therefore, God perfects man gradually according to his human nature, and proceeds from the lowest and most exterior to the highest and most interior. He first perfects the corporeal senses, moving one to make use of natural exterior objects that are good, such as hearing sermons and masses, looking upon holy objects, mortifying the palate at meals, and disciplining the sense of touch through penance and holy rigor. When these senses are somewhat disposed, he is wont to perfect them more than granting by some supernatural favors and gifts to confirm them further in good. These supernatural communications are, for example, corporeal visions of saints or holy things, very sweet odors, locutions, and extreme delight in the sense of touch. The senses are greatly confirmed in virtue through these communications, and the appetites withdrawn from evil objects. Besides this, the interior bodily senses, such as the imagination and fantasy, are gradually perfected and accustomed to good through considerations, meditations, and holy reasonings, and the spirit is instructed. When through this natural exercise they are prepared, God may enlighten and spiritualize them further with some supernatural imaginative visions from which the spirit, as we affirmed at the same time, profits notably. This natural and supernatural exercise of the interior sense gradually reaffirms and refines the spirit. This is God's method of bringing a soul step by step to the innermost good. Although it may not always be necessary for him to keep so mathematically to this order, for sometimes God bestows one kind of communication without the other, or a less interior one by means of a more interior one, or both together. The process depends on what God judges expedient for the soul, or upon the favors he wants to confer. But his ordinary procedure conforms with our explanation. By this method, then, God instructs a person and makes him spiritual. He begins by communicating spirituality in accord with the person's littleness and small capacity through elements that are exterior, palpable, and accommodated to sense. He does this so that by means of the rind and those sensible things, in themselves good, the spirit making progress in particular acts and receiving morsels of spiritual communication may form a habit of spiritual things and reach the actual substance of spirit, foreign to all sense. A person only obtains this little by little, after his own manner, and by means of the senses to which he has always been attached. If in the measure that a man approaches spirit in his dealings with God, he divests and empties himself of the ways of the senses, of discursive and imaginative meditation. When he has completely attained spiritual communion with God, he will be avoided of all sensory apprehensions concerning God. The more an object approaches one extreme, the further it retreats from the other. Upon complete attainment of one extreme, it will be wholly separated from the other. There is a frequently quoted spiritual axiom which runs, "Once the taste and savor of the spirit is experienced, everything carnal is insipid. The ways of the flesh, which refer to the use of the senses in spiritual things, afford neither profit nor delight." This is obvious. If something is spiritual, it is incomprehensible to the senses. But if the senses can grasp it, it is no longer purely spiritual. The more knowledge the senses and the natural apprehensions have about it, the less spiritual and supernatural it will be, as we explained above. As a result, the perfect spirit pays no attention to the senses. It neither receives anything through them, nor uses them principally, nor judges them to be requisite in its relationship with God, as it did before its spiritual growth. A passage from St. Paul's Epistle to the Corinthians bears this meaning. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I knew as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. We have already explained how sensible things and the knowledge the spirit can abstract from them are the work of a child. Should a person always have attachment to them and never become detached, he would never stop being the little child, or speaking of God as a child, or knowing and thinking of God as a child. In his attachment to the rind of sense, the child, he will never reach the substance of spirit, the perfect man. For the sake of his own spiritual growth, therefore, a person should not admit these revelations, even though God is the author of them, just as a child must be weaned in order to accustom its palate to a heartier and more substantial diet. It is necessary, you may ask, for the soul, while it is a child, to accept these sensible things and then set them aside when grown, just as an infant must be nourished at the breast until, when grown older, it can be weaned. I reply in regard to discursive meditation, in which an individual begins his quest for God, that it is true that he must not turn away from the breast of the senses for his nourishment until he arrives at the time and the season suitable for so doing. That is, when God brings the soul to a more spiritual converse, to contemplation, of which we spoke in chapter 11 of this book.